won the fastest, and the prize for second place is a ride in a squad car.
Murphy wasn't buying it. I'm not sure.
Don't interrupt,
the disembodied voice on the phone said, interrupting him. Just because Murphy wasn't buying it didn't mean the voice had to stop selling it.
And furthermore, if that's how dangerous the law-abiding citizens are, you can imagine how treacherous the criminals would be. There's no honor among thieves, and even less among Floridians. If a criminal finds an escaped convict, they see the perfect victim. They can rob him of whatever he's managed to steal with impunity. Because what's he gonna do? Call the police. And if he hasn't managed to steal any money, clothes, or a car yet, you can just befriend him, help him steal all of those things, then take them yourself later. Agent Murphy, if I escaped from a prison in South Florida, I'd try to swim to Cuba. At least sharks play fair, and the communists are up front about taking everything you own.
This was a lot to absorb at 3 a.m., and Agent Murphy had almost forgotten what they were talking about in the first place. The voice reminded him, telling him that he was to report alone to the front gate of the prison at 3 p.m. Eastern Time in 2 days, and that he'd be allowed to meet with the prisoner, Todd Douglas, for exactly 20 minutes. Murphy, Miller, and Jimmy scrambled to make a plan. Then they scrambled to execute it. By the time they were done, Murphy barely had time to make it to his flight. The Treasury had approved the expenditure to pay for his travel, but, as always, they made the arrangements with an eye towards saving their money, not his time. There are direct flights from Los Angeles to Miami, but Agent Murphy's itinerary had 3 legs and layovers in Minneapolis and Seattle, because fate has a sense of humor, before landing in Jacksonville, at the far end of the state from where he needed to be. Agent Murphy told his supervisor that this was a massive waste of his time. His supervisor replied that Agent Murphy was paid a salary, so his time was the agency's to waste. The flights were awful, and the drive had been worse. Several times he had driven through swarms of black insects that died in such large numbers and in such a gruesome fashion that it made it impossible to see through the windshield. Every rest area and gas station had lines of bug-splattered cars waiting to use a hose. The first time he stopped to clean the car had been seriously unpleasant. The nose of his silver rental car looked like it had been scorched during re-entry, but the black streaks weren't burn marks, they were bug corpses. The car reeked of death. He used the dirtiest squeegee he'd ever seen to clean as much of the windshield as he could without throwing up. He got back in the car, got back on the freeway, and within 15 minutes drove through another swarm that obscured his vision all over again. By the time he reached his destination, Agent Murphy longed for his days in the boxcar full of squeaky toys, but he made it. Murphy thought he was going to see a prison, but when he arrived, he found a perfectly mundane, if oversized, industrial park. The front of the closest building was a long row of office entrances. He saw an unbroken line of tinted windows, tinted glass doors, and uninspiring signs with names like Fan-rific Industrial Venting Solutions, and logos that were capital letters tilted to the side to look like they were moving quickly, or leaning over, partially melted in the Florida heat, which seemed more likely. The building had probably been beige at first, but prolonged exposure to the Florida sun had left it a dirty eggshell color. Behind the one-story office fronts, there were larger two-story structures that looked like the standard industrial park storage workshop loading dock multi-use business space. The whole property was surrounded by a cyclone fence topped with vicious-looking razor wire. Murphy drove up to the security booth, where a dull-eyed old man in a faded uniform slouched on a stool, watching a small TV. Murphy sat in his idling car, trying to ignore the oppressive heat and the smell of baked bug guts rising off of his car in almost visible waves. The guard glanced at Agent Murphy without turning his head. He sighed, then slid the window open so he could talk to this man who had the audacity to interrupt his stories. The security guard said,
"What'd you want?"
Murphy held up his badge and said,
"I'm Agent Dwayne Murphy from the U.S. Department of the Treasury. I have an appointment?"
The guard nodded, then looked down at a clipboard on the shelf next to his TV. His finger trailed down the document, then stopped sharply. The guard sat straight up, turned crisply to Agent Murphy, and smiled. He instantly seemed 10 years younger and 20 pounds lighter. The guard said,
"We're expecting you, Agent Murphy. Come right in. Warden Brooks is waiting at the visitor's entrance. It's the fourth door down, labeled My Shirtless Novelty Tees."
He slid the window closed and raised the orange and white striped arm so Murphy could enter. Murphy found the door. The logo was a drawing of a T-shirt with a capital T in an overly decorative font. He parked, got out of the car, and pushed the car door closed with one finger, pressing on one of the few surfaces of the car that wasn't streaked with sticky, dried bug juice. Murphy walked into the nondescript office entrance and was shocked at what he found inside. Exactly what you'd expect. A drop tile ceiling and fluorescent lights hung above off-white stucco walls and low-pile high-traffic carpet. A metal faux wood grain desk and a black plastic desk chair were the only furnishings. The desk was covered with paperwork, a red stapler, and a black multi-line phone. The only other door was behind the desk. It looked to be hollow core and probably weighed about 8 ounces. It had a cheap, shiny brass doorknob. The room reeked of dust and failure, which was better than humidity and dead bugs, but only a little. Murphy had been inside less than 5 seconds when the door swung open. A man in a beautifully tailored black pinstriped suit entered. He was average height with thinning black hair. He looked like the kind of man who would play the president in a 1950s movie about giant wasps. He stepped forward, thrust out his hand, and said, "Agent Murphy, I'm Warden Brooks. Welcome to the facility." Murphy shook his hand and asked,
"It certainly is quite a facility. I just realized that nobody's ever told me what this place is called."
Warden Brooks said,
"I just told you, Agent Murphy, it's called the facility."
"Yes, I understand that that's what you call it, but what's its official name?"
Warden Brooks smiled, but clearly had been through this conversation many times before and derived no pleasure from it.
"This facility's name, Agent Murphy, is the facility. Anytime anybody refers to the facility in any capacity, official or unofficial, they refer to it as the facility."
"What kind of name is that?"
"The kind that confuses people and makes them sound either stupid or crazy. It is, in short, the perfect name for this kind of facility. Please, follow me."
With that, Warden Brooks walked out through the flimsy door he had used to enter. Murphy followed. The cheap door led from the shabby office to a crummy hall. One side of the hall held 2 more faux veneer hollow core doors and 2 shiny doorknobs. One had a drab brown plastic sign that said "Men." The other had a similar sign that said "Ladies." Warden Brooks walked to the unmarked door at the end of the hall, but paused before opening it.
"You need to use the restroom?"
Murphy said,
"No."
"Good. We deliberately keep those bathrooms dirty and short of toilet paper. We must keep up appearances."
The warden led Murphy onward through the door. Every characteristic changed. The hard carpeting was replaced with slightly softer-looking concrete floors. The stucco was displaced with painted cinder block. The suspended acoustic ceiling was now exposed metal trusses and ductwork. The design aesthetic had changed from the kind of cheap that falls apart immediately to the kind of cheap that lasts forever. The warden walked quickly and talked at the same pace, forcing Murphy to struggle physically and mentally to keep up. They passed through an endless maze of identical concrete walls and steel doors, interspersed with the occasional staircase and wrought iron gate controlled by people in uniforms protected behind thick, impact-resistant glass. Murphy never got a good look at any of these people because they never stopped walking. The gate swung open before the warden arrived. They did this with such reliability that a few times Murphy thought Brooks was going to walk face first into the bars, but the bars always got out of the way before that happened.
"The facility was created at an undisclosed point in the past," the warden said, "for an agency that is classified by a president who shall remain nameless."
He barely turned his head to the side to speak to Murphy as he walked.
The purpose of the facility is to house the nation's most problematic prisoners.
By problematic, you mean violent and dangerous,
Agent Murphy said, finally feeling like he was getting a handle on the situation. Warden Brooks said,
No, I said problematic, and that's what I meant. The prison system doesn't consider violence much of a problem. They deal with it all the time. If prisons had a problem dealing with violence, the prisoners would just fight their way out of prison and we'd all have a problem and violence before too long. No, we get the prisoners that nobody else knows what to do with. Take your man Todd Douglas. Do you know what he did to get here?
Murphy didn't know, as it happened. He took a wild guess, based on his knowledge of Jimmy's other associates.
Embezzling?
The warden laughed.
Ha! You're a treasury agent, that's right. It's all embezzlement and tax evasion to you guys. Well, he might have embezzled, too, but what got him here was killing a man. The victim was his boss at one of those strip mall video game stores. Do you know how he killed him?
No, I don't.
Yeah, well, neither do we. Well, we do, but we don't. That's one of the things that makes your guy problematic. We know what he did, and we know why, but we can't explain how he actually did it.
Murphy was lost.
How's that work? If you know he killed the guy, you have to be able to explain how.
He made all of the atoms in his boss's body lose their molecular bonds at the same time. Can you explain how he did that? Is that something the Treasury deals with routinely? No, I didn't think so.
If you don't know how he did it, how can you know that he did it?
Because he had a beef with his boss, because he tried to evade capture, and because of all the people who worked at the video game store inside a mall in Phoenix in August, he was the only one who came to work wearing galoshes.
Murphy said,
Ick.
The warden nodded.
Damn straight, Ick. The entire carpet was destroyed, every square inch of it. Whole thing got confiscated by the government for study. It's probably rolled up and sitting next to the Ark of the Covenant by now.
Murphy said,
If he's that dangerous, I can see why they'd send him to a place like this.
The warden shook his head.
No, you're making too many assumptions. We don't know how he liquefied that guy, but we've seen no evidence that he can still do it. We've had him here for 6 years, and he hasn't heard a fly. Mr. Douglas is here for two reasons. One is that we can't explain what he did, how he escaped capture at first, or how he was captured in the end. The police got called, and they immediately started questioning him. He was pretty cocky until they started asking about the galoshes. Then he got nervous. He excused himself, went into a restroom that had no exits beyond the one door the cops were guarding, and he never came out.
That's something,
Murphy said. He chose not to share the story about how Martin Banks had disappeared right before his eyes. The warden continued.
Yeah, well, the weird part was at that exact moment he turns up in the lobby of Phoenix City Hall, stark naked and hog-tied, and get this, his hair was longer and he had a beard.
Jimmy hadn't told Murphy much about this Todd character. He now suspected he was going to have a long conversation with Jimmy about him. For now, Murphy just said,
That's pretty weird, all right.
Yeah, well, you should be grateful,
Warden Brooks said.
The only reason we're letting you see the little weasel is that we're hoping that it will lead to some answers.
Murphy chose not to comment. Instead, he changed the subject.
You said there were two reasons he's here?
Yeah, you'll see.
The two men walked in silence through a few more twists and turns of the corridor. Murphy hoped the warden would lead him back out, or else he'd never find his way to daylight again, and might end up just getting a job there. Finally, they rounded the last corner and approached the last gate. Where Murphy would have expected to see another electronically actuated lock, the gate was instead held fast with a very large, very old-looking mechanical lock. Several feet before the gate, a guard sat on a stool, guarding a single, oversized key that hung from a spike driven into the mortar between the cinder blocks in the wall. Murphy got the pleasure of surprising the warden with his lack of surprise.
Oh, his magnetic field is the other thing, huh?
The warden scowled.
You knew about that?
Agent Murphy said.
Yes.
They eyeballed each other for a moment. It was clear that there was a battle for dominance going on, and that up until a second ago, Warden Brooks was certain he was winning. Murphy, as was his way, had won the whole game by pretending not to play until the last few seconds. Agent Murphy had walked into this meeting knowing exactly two things about Todd beyond his name. He withheld the information about the magnetic field until after Warden Brooks shared a great deal of new information, and in doing so gave the impression that he already knew much of what Brooks had told him, and had been humoring him. The other thing Agent Murphy knew, he had already decided he could never share, because he didn't really believe it. Jimmy had told him that Todd had traveled in time to the distant past, and had been rejected and sent back by Jimmy and all of the other time travelers. The warden grumbled under his breath as he removed his watch and cell phone, placing them on a small table next to the locked gate. Murphy did the same. When all electronic devices were safely removed, the guard opened the gate and let them through. The cinder block hallway that stretched on beyond the gate was structurally identical to the hallway before, but felt entirely different. The overhead fluorescent light fixtures were dark. Instead, bare incandescent light bulbs hung from the ceiling at regular intervals. Their cords stretched up to the ceiling, where they looked to have been hastily stapled in place. The cords led to the wall, then down to the floor, then back, along the floorboards and through the gate they'd just passed, finally terminating in a cheap power strip plugged into the wall outlet. The hanging lights were dimmer than the fluorescents, and swung slightly in the breeze, making the shadows wobble unnervingly. Their footsteps echoed as the warden walked down the hall and around the corner. Murphy followed, and finally laid eyes on Todd Douglas. Murphy saw a prison cell. The only furniture was a toilet and a bed. The only light came from more poorly hung light bulbs dangling outside the cell, well beyond the prisoner's reach. The back wall of the cell was stacked from the floor to about waist height with books, most of them so thin as to barely qualify as anything more than a magazine. A man in an orange jumpsuit sat on the bed, reading a skinny book with a glossy cover. The back of the book had a drawing of a little girl and a man in a diving suit. The warden barked, "Douglas, get up! You have a visitor!" The prisoner slammed the book shut and turned to face Agent Murphy. He had a weak chin, a strong nose, dark hair, and bright eyes. Todd rose to his feet. His movements were slow, but his eyes darted around, taking in every detail of his visitors so voraciously that Agent Murphy almost felt violated. Todd grabbed the bars of his cell and leaned forward, almost placing his head between the bars, as if trying to get as close to the other two men as possible.
"Hello, I'm Todd Douglas. Thank you for coming to visit me."
Murphy stood tall and said,
"I'm not here for pleasure, Mr. Douglas."
"Oh, but having you here is a pleasure for me,"
the prisoner said.
I see some of the guards every day, and I see Warden Brooks here about once a month, but other than that, I never get any visitors. What's your name?"
"I'm Agent Murphy. I'm with the Department of the Treasury."
Murphy produced his badge. Todd read every word engraved in it. When he was finished, Todd asked,
"Do you play video games?"
"Not since I was in college."
"Oh, that's a shame. They've gotten so good. They're doing amazing things these days. The standards for the graphics have gotten so high, even the worst games look great. So they've had to start getting more creative with the story."
Murphy looked down at the thin booklet Todd had been reading when he entered, which was lying on the bed. It was indeed the strategy guide for a game called BioShock 2. Todd saw where he was looking and said,
"The BioShock games are a good example. At first glance, you might think it's just a game where you run around shooting people, but there's a lot more to do than that."
Murphy was trying to make sense of the image on the cover, which was a city, a whale, and a man in a diving suit with a drill for an arm. While pondering this, he absent-mindedly said,
"Is there?"
"Oh, yeah!"
Todd enthused.
"There's a ton of ways to kill people in that game other than just shooting them. You can beat them, you can electrocute them, you can set them on fire, you can blow them up, you can throw them across the room with your mind, you can have them stung to death by bees. There's all kinds of ways to kill people."
"In the video game," Murphy said.
"Yeah,"
Todd said.
"Just like in real life."
Murphy asked,
"Do you enjoy killing people? In video games, Todd?"
Todd's expression soured.
"I used to. I haven't been able to play any for a long time."
Todd motioned to the giant stack of magazines.
I read the strategy guides, but it's not the same.
The warden cleared his throat, which Murphy interpreted as a signal to get on to business. Murphy said,
Mr. Douglas.
Todd interrupted, saying,
You can call me Todd.
The warden said,
No, he can't.
Murphy started again.
Mr. Douglas, I brought you a message.
He reached into his inside pocket and produced a sealed envelope. Todd's eyes followed the envelope.
Who's it from?
Todd asked. Murphy silently turned the envelope around so that Todd could see where Jimmy had written Merlin in the fanciest script he could muster with a number two pencil. Todd's expression changed instantly from a smile to a snarl.
What does he want?
Murphy handed him the letter.
Read it and find out.
Murphy hadn't told the warden about the letter. It wouldn't have made sense to the warden if he had. Todd snatched the letter away before the warden had a chance to object, retreating to the back of his cell. He scowled as he tore the envelope open. He unfolded the letter and started reading, his lips moving slightly as he did so. He laughed bitterly, then he cursed, then he continued reading in silence. When he finished the letter, he closed his eyes and clenched his fists, crumpling the letter in the process. Then he smoothed out the letter and read it again. When he'd finished the second read-through, he turned to Agent Murphy.
You got a pen and paper?
Agent Murphy reached into his pocket and produced a notepad and a pen, which he clicked open. Todd said,
You write this down, 'cause I'm only gonna say it once.
22. Philip opened his eyes and saw a sideways landscape of unfamiliar pillows in the foreground, an unfamiliar wall in the background, and Britt the Younger's sleeping face in between. He took a moment to collect his thoughts. As his brain booted up, he replayed the previous night in his memory. When he was done, he went back and replayed a couple of his favorite bits a couple of times. Pleasant though the past was, Philip knew it was time to deal with the present. He looked at Britt and reflected on the fact that the present seemed pretty nice too. The future, however, was a minefield.
If I get up and leave, he thought, I'm the selfish guy who got what he wanted and ran. If I stick around, I'm the clingy guy who overstayed his welcome. I'd better decide what to do fast, or else she'll wake up and I'll be the creepy guy who was watching her sleep with a worried look on his face.
What Philip needed was a distraction, something that would wake her up and hold her attention through the awkward, Hey, why is Philip here?
Oh, that's right,
phase of the morning. Philip knew that his staff was nearby, and he might be able to magic up a diversion, but in order for that to work, he'd have to put on his robe and hat, and he especially didn't want her to wake up and find him getting dressed. Besides, all of the spells that he could think of to use as a distraction were sort of a dead giveaway. He pictured himself saying,
Ha! Look at that, Britt! A 6-foot pillar of flame here in your bedroom for no reason! That's something, isn't it? No, and now it's gone. So, how did you sleep?
Philip felt despair. Then he felt anger at himself for being the guy that wakes up in bed with a beautiful woman and has it cause him despair. He rolled onto his back and resigned himself to wait for the inevitable awkwardness when Britt awoke. He looked at the ceiling for a few moments. Then the door swung open. Nick swept into the room with a tray of food and a glass of some sort of juice.
Good morning,
he said as he walked around to Philip's side of the bed. Philip sat up and Nick placed the tray on his lap.
Good morning, Nick.
Philip said, grateful, not just for the food, but also for a far better distraction than which he had imagined. The plate on his tray contained eggs and some sort of fried meat. Philip hadn't realized he was hungry until he saw the food. And now he could think of little else. He turned to look at Britt and found her bleary-eyed but awake and pulling herself into a seated position. Nick said,
Don't go anywhere. Now that our guest has been served, I'll be right back with yours.
Britt and Philip smiled at each other and said good morning. Philip said,
Nick seems to be in a good mood today.
Yeah, Britt said. I'm sure he's happy. He always says I should have a man in my life.
Philip said,
What about him?
Nick returned with an identical tray of food, which he placed on Britt's lap, and said,
I already have enough men in my life, but thanks for asking.
They enjoyed their breakfast in a cheerful, mutual silence. When they were finished eating, Britt turned to Philip, smiled, and said,
So.
Philip returned the smile and said,
So. Okay, he thought. The ball's in her court. Let's see what she does with it.
Britt said,
I think last night went very well.
Philip laughed, largely out of relief, and said,
I wholeheartedly agree.
Philip thought he sensed some relief in Britt's laugh as well. After a long pause, Britt asked,
Do you think Martin suspects?
Philip said,
I don't think he suspects. I think he's absolutely certain.
Really?
Yeah, he knew where I was going. He knows I didn't come back. He's not concerned for my safety, or else he'd have called.
Britt nodded.
Yep, Martin knows.
Philip looked at Britt sideways and said,
Look, if that's a problem, I can just go back in time to an hour after I left. I could tell him that you were fine and nothing happened. Of course, my internal clock would be 8 hours off then, and I'd probably fall asleep in our meetings today, but I'll do it if you want.
Britt put her hand on Philip's to stop him.
No, it's fine, Philip. I don't mind him knowing. Do you think he'll tell anyone?
Gwen, Philip said. He probably already has.
Really?
Yeah, Philip said. It's an excuse to talk to Gwen, and Martin never passes up one of those.
But it's so early.
Philip held up a finger as if to say, one moment, then he held up his right hand and said,
Comunique con Martin.
The empty space in Philip's palm was filled with a silvery, glowing image of the bust of Santo, the Mexican wrestler from Martin's staff. Normally, an eerie organ sting would have played to signify Martin's phone ringing, but it barely started before Martin answered. The bust of Santo was replaced with the head and shoulders of Martin, who had a sickeningly happy look on his face. Martin said,
Yeah?
Philip said,
Hi, Martin.
Martin kept smiling. Neither man said anything until Martin finally asked,
Are you...
His voice trailed off and he shrugged, but he still had the same nauseating smile. Philip sighed and said,
Yes, I'm with Britt.
Martin laughed diabolically and gave exaggerated thumbs up. The laugh went on much longer than was dignified, which was, of course, exactly how Martin wanted it. Philip said,
Okay, okay. Look, have you told Gwen yet?
Of course,
Martin said.
She's here right now.
Gwen's head appeared over Martin's shoulder. She had the same sickening smile on her face.
Good for you, Philip. Where are you now?
Philip winced and admitted,
I'm at Britt's place.
Gwen said,
Oh, put her on.
Britt leaned in close, and Philip twisted his arm so that her head would be in view. Britt said,
Good morning.
Instead of saying good morning back, Gwen gave an enthusiastic thumbs up and laughed like a crazy woman. She did this alone for a moment. Then Martin joined her, both in the laughing and the thumbs up. Britt and Philip laughed a bit in spite of themselves. Then Philip said,
Oh, shut up. We'll see you both at the summit.
He clenched his hand, hanging up. The night before, Martin had waited for Philip to finally do what they both knew he wanted to, go check on Britt. Then he'd waited for Philip to return. Then, when it became clear that he wouldn't be back that night, he waited until morning when he could talk about it with Philip if Philip showed up, and Gwen if he didn't. When morning came, it was clear that Philip had not returned, so Martin arranged to meet Gwen for breakfast. That's where they were when they got Philip's call. They had a table at a surprisingly modern outdoor cafe. Martin was not surprised to find that coffee was on the menu, despite the fact that South America wouldn't be discovered by Europe for hundreds of years. He was surprised at how good it was, though. When Gwen arrived, they ordered their breakfast. Then Martin shared his news, which made both of them very happy, not just because their friends were presumably happy, but also because they could good-naturedly rake both of them over the coals about it for a few days. The phone call came just before their food arrived. They spent the meal idly discussing the situation while they ate.
"I'm surprised that Philip worked so fast," Gwen said. "He's never seemed all that romantic to me."
"Well, he doesn't show that side to you, Gwen. You're like a sister to him."
Gwen smiled.
"Are you saying he's shown that side of himself to you?"
Not directly, Martin said, just defensively enough to make it clear he was in on the joke. "But I know it's there. Guys like Philip are like, you know those cheap frozen chicken pot pies you get from the grocery store? Philip's like one of those. He's all bland and beige on the surface, a little bit flaky, too. But underneath, on the inside, he's a scalding hot bubbling mass of passion and gravy and peas."
"And chicken," Gwen offered.
"Well, less than you'd think," Martin said.
Back at Britt's apartment, she and Philip were dressed and ready to face the day, but not together. They had decided that it would be for the best to keep things quiet for now, and both of them emerging from her front door didn't feel like the way to make that happen. Instead, they decided that she would leave via the door and walk to the summit as usual, and that Philip would teleport back to his room and go to the summit from there. Nick came out to the living room to see them off, but was not having much success at it.
"Go on," Philip said. "Get going. Once you're gone, I'll teleport out and meet you at the summit."
Britt said,
"No, you go first, then I'll go."
Philip shook his head.
"No, you go now, then me."
Britt crossed her arms.
"I don't see why I should go first."
"Maybe I enjoy watching you walk away."
Britt blushed slightly, then said,
"Maybe I enjoy watching you walk away."
Philip said,
"See, I'm going to teleport, so all you'd see is me disappearing. There's not a lot of fun in that."
Nick said,
"I disagree. Look, you two kids have to get going or you'll both be late, and that'll look just as suspicious as you two leaving here together anyway."
Britt said,
"Nick's right."
"Yeah,"
Philip said. Britt said,
"I should go."
Philip said,
"Yeah, me too."
Philip and Britt said in unison,
"Right after you."
Then they laughed like teenagers. Nick walked over and opened the door. He grabbed Britt by the hand and said,
"Come on, time to go. The sooner you two get to your meeting, the more time you can spend making googly eyes at each other,"
as he pulled her out the door. Gwen lifted her napkin from her lap and put it on her plate before pushing the plate away.
"You have to hand it to Britt and Philip," she said, settling back in her seat. "They figured out what they wanted, and they didn't waste a lot of time getting it."
Martin took his time parsing Gwen's statement. After mentally double-checking it, he leaned forward and said,
"You know, when I realized that Philip wasn't coming back, I seriously considered coming to visit you."
"Really?"
Gwen said. Martin said,
"Yeah."
They stared at each other for a moment. Then Martin asked,
"Should I have?"
Gwen shrugged and said,
"If you have to ask, then probably not."
She smiled as she said it, but that didn't alter the meaning much for Martin. He chuckled once, mirthlessly, and said,
"Then I'm glad I didn't,"
as he stood up to leave. Gwen smiled and said,
"Oh, Martin."
Martin leaned in and said,
"Gwen, save it. Look, I've made my position perfectly clear."
"Perfectly,"
Gwen said.
"Yes, when you say that, like it's something I should be embarrassed about. But I'm not embarrassed. I'm interested. I have been since day one, and I am now. If something's holding us up, it's not me. So please, don't act like my uncertainty is the problem."
Gwen's smile disappeared.
"What are you saying?"
"I'm saying exactly what it sounds like I'm saying. That's the beauty of me, Gwen. I'm clear. You, on the other hand, hint that I'm not direct enough, but every time I've tried to take the bull by the horns, you've shot me down."
"And then you've mixed your metaphors."
Gwen's smile came back, but it had changed, and not for the better. Martin said,
"A mixed metaphor is like a beautiful woman."
"How so?"
"They can both make a guy look stupid."
Martin turned to leave, but only got one step before his right hand started glowing and emitting a chime. Martin's shoulders sagged as he lifted his hand, answering the call.
"What?"
Martin said. Philip's face appeared in Martin's hand. He looked panicked.
Martin, is Gwen still with you?
Yeah?
Good. You two come meet me at the doctor's now. There's been another attack on Brit.
Gwen heard. Martin hung up, and a second later they both disappeared. Across the street, Ampix put down the brand new kilt he hadn't really been considering buying, shook his head, and walked away. 23.
Shut up, Jimmy! I've heard enough out of you. I wish I'd never met you. You've been nothing but trouble to my partner and me, and I curse the day you turned yourself in!
Agent Miller shook his head, put his hand on Agent Murphy's shoulder, and said,
Take it easy, Murph.
Murphy's calm facade was usually impenetrable, but a man can only take so much, and Jimmy had given them more than enough. In the short time they'd known Jimmy, they'd gone from being federal agents, treated with fear and respect by the civilians, to being hobos, treated with scorn and contempt by railroad security, which was a clear demotion. Then they'd gone from being hobos to being security guards at a warehouse full of old files, which, while less clear, they still saw as a demotion. At least hobos choose to do nothing. Watchmen are ordered to do nothing. They'd been deprived of sleep, of their homes, of human interaction, and of their dignity. Miller had spent most of the time yelling, but Murphy allowed himself no such outlet, and instead kept it all bottled up. He'd remained good-natured and cheerful through the entire ordeal, including his trip to Florida. He even came back laughing about the flight home, in which he had the middle seat between two rather large people, who both had raised their armrests. He had returned with Todd's answer to Jimmy. Murphy didn't have to read it. He'd had it dictated to him, and he knew it to be a string of tech gibberish. Arcane abbreviations, directions to do things that made no sense to him. Stuff like, type dir, select menu item 3, use trumpet windsock. He knew roughly what it all meant, but he was unsure that it would have any effect. He transcribed the instructions as best he could and delivered them to Jimmy. Now, together, they were trying to follow them, and it was slow going, made worse by Jimmy. He was clearly getting frustrated, and it was making him bossy, which was the last straw for Agent Murphy. After Murphy finally blew up, it fell to Miller to be the voice of reason.
Now, now, Murph, he said. Losing your temper won't accomplish anything.
Murphy sputtered.
But you're always losing your temper!
Yes, but I'm good at it. You're not. Watch and learn.
Miller looked at Jimmy, sitting there at the far end of the warehouse, holding his tin can and peering at them through his telescope. Miller held his can up to his mouth, which Jimmy took as a cue to lift his can to his ear. The string pulled tight, and Miller spoke.
Jimmy, I speak for both my partner, Agent Murphy, and myself when I say that we both deeply regret his outburst.
I'm certain that you do,
Jimmy said magnanimously.
Yes. It wasn't nearly harsh enough.
With that, Agent Miller threw open the valve on a fire hose of profanities delivered at top volume, and with the occasional hint of vibrato that is the mark of a true virtuoso. Jimmy took the can away from his ear, then put it back, because due to the volume of Miller's voice and the acoustic qualities of the warehouse, the obscenities were actually quieter through the can. When Agent Miller had finally run through the entire Urban Dictionary, and good portions of the Thesaurus, and a rhyming dictionary, the torrent finally petered out. Through the tin can, Jimmy heard Agent Miller say, in a quiet voice, heavy with menace,
Now you look, Jimmy. My partner Murph has shown the patience of a saint. He's doing the best he can to follow those ridiculous directions. So you need to cool your jets, or I'm going to come over there, and the last thing you'll ever hear will be my tinny laughter as I strangle you with your own soup can telephone.
Actually,
Jimmy said,
if the string was pulled tight around my neck, the sound vibrations wouldn't carry through the string.
There was a long silence. Then Jimmy added,
I apologize. Correcting you then was probably not the smart move. I know that working with me has not been pleasant for either of you, and that so far there's been nothing to show for it. But I tell you, we're very close to our goal.
Jimmy took the silence as encouragement and continued.
It's just these instructions of Todd's. It's been years since he's done the things he's telling us to do, and, well, as Agent Murphy told you, Todd's not the brightest man. He's shrewd enough to be dangerous to others, but dumb enough to be even more of a danger to himself.
Miller finally broke his silence to ask,
So, do you think this is going to work or not, Jimmy?
Jimmy said,
We are going to find the file. And when we do, I will prove that everything I've told you is true, but it's going to be a frustrating process. I promise, I'll be more patient. Please give Agent Murphy my apologies.
The three men got back to work. Jimmy deciphered Todd's instructions and watched through his telescope as Agent Murphy attempted to follow them. Finally, they wound their way around the internet and onto some sort of massive corporate database. Jimmy could tell from the address that it belonged to a large gaming company. After several more nonsensical blind alleys, they were looking at a directory with one file in it, a file called repository1-c.txt. Jimmy told Murphy to open the file remotely using the terminal, as they had tried several times before. Unlike all of the other times, this time the file opened. Jimmy said,
Okay, gentlemen, here comes your proof. Do a search for my full name, James Isidore Sadler.
Agent Miller's voice came back through the tin can.
It's searching. How long will this take?
Usually about 20 minutes, but it depends on the speed of the server we're accessing.
9 minutes later, the search returned a single match. Jimmy silently thanked his parents for giving him a ridiculous middle name, then instructed Murphy to pull up the entry that Jimmy knew defined him as a person. Jimmy didn't need to work very hard to remember which number they were looking for. He had rehearsed this moment thousands of times in his mind. He led Agent Murphy to a specific set of digits and instructed him to read them aloud. Murphy took the can from Miller. His tinny voice said,
It says 500.
Yeesh, Philip,
Jimmy thought.
That's overkill.
Jimmy put the can to his mouth and said,
Change that to 12.
12?
Yes, 12.
Murphy hesitated.
What'll this do?
Jimmy tried to sound calm as he explained,
If I've been telling you the truth, it'll reset my magnetic field so I can use electronics again.
And if you're not telling the truth?
Nothing,
Jimmy said.
I mean, it's just some random file some game company's holding on to, right? If I'm lying, the worst that can happen is it'll break some game and they'll have to restore a backed-up copy of the file. Besides, the file has my name in it, right? So this is my entry, and I'm having you adjust the number down, not up, so I can't possibly be stealing anything, can I?
That seemed to satisfy Murphy. Jimmy couldn't hear the clicking, but he watched through the telescope as Murphy made the change. Jimmy sat for a moment, concentrating on enjoying the moment. Eventually, Agent Miller yelled,
Hey! What next?
From the far end of the warehouse. Jimmy stood up, straightened his rumpled second-hand suit jacket, and walked toward the agents, never taking his eyes off of the computer monitor. He walked at a normal pace, but to him it felt agonizingly slow. With each step, the screen got closer. And with each step, he became more certain that at any second it would flicker and go dead. He kept walking like that, each step expecting the screen to die, until he couldn't walk any further without kicking the table on which the computer sat. Miller and Murphy both looked shocked, but Jimmy didn't know it. He couldn't take his eyes off of the screen. It was the first time he'd seen a video display of any kind from closer than 15 feet in 30 years, and it was the most beautiful thing he'd ever seen. Murphy muttered several obscenities. Miller said,
Okay, so we can stand next to a computer. What's that prove?
Jimmy said,
It proves I was telling the truth.
Not about everything,
Agent Miller said.
We didn't arrest the bank's kid for standing next to computers. We arrested him for producing money out of nothing. Frankly, I'm still not convinced this whole magnetic field thing hasn't been a trick from day one.
Agent Murphy rolled his eyes.
Miller, how could he possibly fake that?
If I could tell you that, it wouldn't be much of a trick.
Jimmy expected this. Circumstances had forced him to prove that what he was saying was true, but proof, as is often the case, wasn't very convincing. Luckily for Jimmy, he was convincing, even when he had no proof. Jimmy smiled and said,
Agent Miller has a valid point. None of the people you've been pursuing were wanted for damaging electronics. I can show you how all of the other things were done, but it'll take a little time.
Agent Miller laughed contemptuously and said,
Yeah, I knew it. How long will it take, Jimmy? How much longer are you going to string us along?
Jimmy said, About 15 minutes. He walked lightly over to the camper and grabbed one of the folding lawn chairs they'd been using to augment the warehouse's furnishings. He brought it back to the table and plunked it down in front of the keyboard.
In the meantime, he said, you gentlemen might want to turn on your cell phones and check your voicemail, since you can now.
Jimmy ran a search on the file for Agent Miller's full name. While it ran, he pulled up the text editor and started typing out strings of code, largely from memory. Agent Murphy asked what he was doing, and Jimmy explained that he was writing a quick script that would automate the process of accessing the file in the future, so they wouldn't have to repeat the whole process they'd just been through. There was a lot that Agent Murphy didn't understand about computers, but neither he nor Miller wanted to go through all of that rigmarole ever again, so they let him proceed. Jimmy checked on the search and found that it had returned 4 people with the same full name as Agent Miller. He got the agent's birth date, and that allowed him to narrow it down to 1.
Okay, gentlemen, for my next trick, Agent Miller, I'll need you to tell me your current checking account balance, down to the penny.
Miller shook his head.
If you think I'm going to give you my checking account number, you're crazy.
I didn't ask you for your checking account number, Jimmy said. Just the balance. As I said, down to the penny.
Miller didn't know his balance, but he was able to call the phone number on the back of his debit card to find out. He carefully guarded his keypad as he entered the number on his debit card, but he needn't have bothered. Jimmy was occupied, putting the finishing touches on his script. After navigating a phone tree, shouting at a phone tree that he didn't want to open a new line of credit, talking to a human, then shouting at the human that he didn't want to open a new line of credit, he got the number he'd wanted.
Okay, my checking balance is $3,762.43.
Jimmy said,
Splendid! Now please hang up the phone.
Jimmy did a quick search, typed a few characters, then told Agent Miller,
Now call again and ask for your balance.
What? Oh man, I had him on the phone! I could have just asked the guy to double-check it. Now I have to go through the whole phone tree again.
Jimmy said,
Please, just call again.
Miller had murder in his eyes, but he made the call, climbed the phone tree, and refused the credit line. Jimmy and Murphy watched with growing anticipation as he got closer and closer to his bank balance. Miller said,
Okay, for bank balance, it says to press 1.
He'd opted to stick with the computer tree for this run, since it aggravated him automatically and impersonally, while the human had done so deliberately for his own enjoyment. He looked at his phone, pressed 1, put the phone back up to his ear, and immediately went white as a sheet. He looked at his phone, pressed 1 again, and held it back to his ear a second time.
What is it? Murphy asked. What does it say?
Jimmy looked at the computer screen and said,
It says that his balance is $5,003,762.43. Doesn't it, Agent Miller?
What did you do?
Agent Miller shouted.
Exactly what I said I would.
Whose money is it?
Jimmy shrugged.
It's in your account. I'd say it's yours.
Miller stood up, towering over Jimmy and bellowing down at him.
Don't you give me that! Who did you take it from?
Nobody, Jimmy said. How could I have? All I did was type a number into the file. You've been sitting right here, and Murphy's been watching me like a hawk the whole time. I haven't pulled up any other systems or accessed any other files. I haven't even contacted your bank. I've been typing away in a text editor the whole time.
You better be able to take it back. Now!
Miller's face was beet red. Spittle rained down on Jimmy.
I will. But first, a little credit, please. I've lived up to my end here. I told you I'd show you how Martin and all the others got their money. And I have.
By making me a criminal?
I can change it back if that's what you really want. But, gentlemen, tell me, is this embezzling? Have we broken the law? We didn't take the money from anywhere. We didn't deprive anyone of anything. Are there laws against altering reality at a fundamental level?
Miller shouted,
You haven't altered reality! I'm not stupid! All you altered was a bank record!
By changing a plain text file that has nothing to do with online banking on a server that belongs to a gaming company?
Jimmy asked calmly.
Don't give me that!
Miller said.
I don't care where this stupid file of yours is. It's computers. They're all tied in together these days. You and your buddies just found a back door or something. That's all!
Jimmy's smile remained in place, but it did become a bit less genuine looking.
Okay, Agent Miller, say that's true. What about my magnetic field, then?
It's a trick!
Miller whined. He turned to his partner.
Murph, you've got to see that this is some kind of trick!
Jimmy turned to Murphy, asked,
How? How could I have made any integrated circuit that got within 15 feet of me stop working?
Agent Murphy asked Agent Miller,
That's a good point. How did he do that?
I don't know!
Agent Miller cried.
Maybe he keistered an electromagnetic!
Jimmy said,
Really now, how likely does that sound?
A lot more likely than you getting godlike powers out of a government-issued Dell!
They both turned to Murphy, who had somehow assumed the role of judge in their group dynamic. Murphy thought for a while, then said in an even tone,
I'm sorry, I just don't buy it. If he keistered an electromagnetic, he'd have stuck to the side of the boxcar.
Jimmy put up his hands and said,
Look, this is a lot to take in, I understand. And you're right that all you've seen me do is change a number on this computer and have it change a number on another computer. I can show you the fancier stuff.
Miller bared his teeth and said,
I think you'd better do that then.
Jimmy said,
Okay.
He turned to the computer and typed in a command. At first, nothing happened. Then more nothing happened. Agent Miller scowled. Jimmy held up a finger and said,
I'm sorry, one second.
He turned back to the computer, looked at the script he'd been writing, muttering to himself. The two agents shared a look that would not have made Jimmy feel safe. Jimmy said,
Ah, there it is. I tell you, you missed one slash.
He stood up again and said,
Sorry about that, guys. It should work this time.
He typed the command, hit enter, and disappeared. The two agents blinked in disbelief. They looked at the space where Jimmy had stood. Then they looked at each other. Then they looked around the warehouse to see where Jimmy went. They didn't see him anywhere. Murphy quickly turned to the computer. Miller saw his partner's head turn and followed suit, just in time to see the screen go black. He looked at Murphy, whose face had gone white.
What happened?
Murphy said,
The last thing I saw was Reformat C drive.
What's that mean?
A distant voice shouted,
It means the memory has been erased!
The agents looked to the chair and telescope at the far end of the warehouse and saw Jimmy wearing a beautifully tailored suit. He had shaved, gotten a haircut, and was holding a tablet computer.
Of course,
Jimmy continued.
A good data recovery specialist could get it all back, but by then I'll have password protected the file anyway, so there's really no point.
Jimmy reached down to the chair, picked up the notebook that contained Todd's instructions, and said,
Just came back for this. Thanks for your assistance, gentlemen.
The two agents started running as fast as they could toward Jimmy, who said,
Keep the $5 million. Consider it a tip. You can use it to pay for anger management classes.
Jimmy poked at the tablet screen and disappeared. 24. Luisa had been a surgeon in Sao Paulo before getting sidetracked into the medical technology field, then eventually finding the file and emigrating to Atlantis. When people arrived in the past, they eventually realized that they still had to do something, and what the people who already lived in the past were doing, such as struggling to find food and shelter, was not, in their case, necessary, nor was it fun. Most time travelers ended up doing pretty much the same thing they did in their original time, and for Luisa, that meant setting up a medical clinic. It passed the time. She was helping the community, and it allowed her to explore the medical applications of the file. Her facilities were beautiful, clean, and modern. Her waiting room was comfortable, spacious, and attractive, and her receptionist was a large, muscular man, who knew how to look at her in just the perfect way to put butterflies in her stomach. He was sitting at his desk, filing his fingernails, when Philip and Britt materialized in the waiting room. Britt was clearly in great distress, and Philip was holding Nick, who had an arrow sticking out of his side. Britt shouted, "We need Luisa now!" The receptionist scarcely had time to stand before Martin and Gwen appeared. Martin immediately helped Philip support Nick, who was moaning and clutching at the arrow. Martin could see that Nick also had deep cuts on his arms. The receptionist hit a button, which was not technically connected to anything, but which still alerted Luisa whenever it was pressed. Martin asked, "What happened?" Britt answered, "We were being silly and Nick was dragging me out of the apartment. As soon as we got out the door, a bunch of arrows flew at me from both ends of the hall." Gwen said, "And poor Nick got in the way." "No," Britt said. "They bounced off of me and hit him." Luisa materialized. She took a second to survey the scene, then leapt into action. Within moments, she and her receptionist had Nick on a gurney that hovered in midair and whisked him away to the examination rooms. They instructed the others to remain in the waiting room. 5 minutes later, Luisa came out to tell them what was happening.
"Luckily, the arrow didn't penetrate very far into his abdomen. I'm going to have to do surgery, but he should pull through just fine."
Britt asked,
"Is he in pain?"
"No,"
Luisa said.
"I froze him in time. He's not even aware that anything's happening."
"And you can perform surgery on him that way?" Philip asked.
"Close. I can't do it with time stopped. With time frozen, he's essentially a statue, but I can slow time to a crawl for him while I do the surgery. I'll have the whole thing done before he has time to flinch."
Britt asked,
"And he won't feel any pain?"
"Oh, he'll feel a tremendous amount of pain, but only for half a second, from his point of view."
Britt said,
"I don't want him to feel any pain."
Luisa said,
"He was in pain when you brought him in. He'll be in pain after the surgery, no matter what I do. We could put him under general anesthetic. I'd have to train someone to monitor his vitals and make sure he doesn't die. Well, we'd have to intubate him. He'd take a long time to wake up, and he'd be groggy and disoriented when he did. Or we can do it my way and get the same result, only I can have it done safely, all by myself, and we'll be done in half an hour."
Philip said,
"You make a convincing argument."
"Also,"
Luisa continued,
"the slow-motion facial reaction to the surgery is usually hilarious."
They left Nick in Luisa's capable hands. She promised to repair the damage, keep him comfortable after the procedure, and record his reactions for them to enjoy later, when they were in the mood. They walked to the summit. They weren't concerned about a new attack because the killer, or killers, seemed to need time to regroup after each failed attempt on Britt's life. Besides, they wanted time to talk. Gwen asked,
"How many arrows was it this time?"
Britt said,
"I didn't take the time to count, but at least 10.
Martin said,
"If one arrow doesn't do it, maybe 10 will. I mean, whoever's doing this, they're either stubborn or stupid, right? It's like one statue didn't do it, let's try a different statue. No, maybe an arrow. No, how about a bunch of arrows? What'll it be next time, 100? Poor Nick getting hit is bad enough, but there could be serious collateral damage if this keeps up. We have to figure out who's doing this."
"Yes, thank you," Philip said. "That hadn't occurred to the rest of us."
"Well, then let's hear some ideas," Martin said. "We need some suspects."
Philip asked,
"Well, what are your ideas, Martin? Or does realizing that we need an idea count as your idea?"
Martin knew Philip was on edge, so he didn't return the snotty tone when he replied,
I don't know the possible suspects nearly as well as Britt and Gwen. But I'll say again that we need to look at who has the most to gain from Britt being out of the picture.
Gwen put her hand on Martin's shoulder.
Martin, we've been through this. Nobody has anything to gain. Anybody who has enough knowledge of magic to make the attempt will know that they can't possibly succeed.
Martin shifted to face Gwen, and in doing so pulled his shoulder out from under her.